Like to call the meeting to order. Roll call. Commissioner Ward.
Here.
Commissioner Studley.
Here.
Commissioner Han. I understand that Commissioner Hansen has an excused absence today. So the first item on the agenda is public comment on matters appearing or not appearing on the agenda that are within the jurisdiction of the Ethics Commission.
Good evening, David Pilpel. Since Commissioner Hansen, you just indicated, won't be present, I just wanted to reference her service on the commission. My understanding is that this would be the last regular commission meeting that she would be eligible for. Perhaps at the next meeting, the commission would want to recognize her years of service. And thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, in response to that comment, we actually did do that in January, and we greatly appreciate Commissioner Hansen's service, and many of us did speak to that effect. Yes?
My name is Shirley Hansen, and I'm the treasurer of a small political club, and I'm just here to complain about the onerous task we have of filling out the ethics reports. Computer program that we have to use is the most ridiculous, terrible atrocity that I've ever encountered, and I used to be a computer programmer. Here's an example of one of the slate cards that our club puts out, and I have written down my comments here. You can each have a copy. The problem is that on these cards, this one, for instance, has 34 candidates or issues. And the number that what you really want and what you really get in the report is 34 numbers. How much did we spend on each candidate or issue, and only if it's over $100. But what we have to do is put it in check by check by check that we wrote, so that for this card, I wrote six checks. That's six checks for 34 candidates. So in the computer, I have to put over 200 numbers, when what you really come out with in the end is 34, except only a few of those are over $100. So what your report is just a few numbers, but this takes hours and hours and hours. And what you have to do first is make an Excel file of your 200 and something numbers. And then you pick out, then you have to put all of these in if they're over $100. What you should be able to do is just say, okay, what is the total amount that you spent on this candidate? Add the six checks together. I mean, even that is a big job. But I would like to recommend that you, if you can't change the computer program that we have to use, that you at least give us some way to do it without having to put it in check by check by check, because it's a ridiculous way to do it. And I think what they tried to do was make the program so it could accommodate all candidates or issues or campaigns, and most of them are just one, would be just one candidate, and so you're just adding up what was spent on this one candidate. Anyway.
Thank you.
Can I just mention, I don't know if you'll be able to stay for the whole meeting, but there is an item on simplification of some of our reporting requirements, and I just want to say that we're trying to think about ways to make things more manageable. I don't know whether it'll address what you're talking about, but it's on our minds. But the general issue is, you know, something we care about. Thank you.
We have 3 minutes, correctly. Could you let me know when I have 1 minute left?
Commissioners Ray Hartz, Director of San Francisco Open Government. I would like to compliment the Ethics Commission staff on being, as the British would say, too clever by half. At the commission meeting of January 10th, 2011, I submitted a 150-word summary and asked that it be included, quote, in the minutes, unquote, in accordance with the Sunshine Ordinance. Today, I visited the Ethics Commission website, read and printed out a copy of the approved minutes. I was not very surprised to see my statement missing. Only upon careful review did I notice a link to the statement, a link which most members of the public would not realize was there, and as a result would not see the statement. What is it that this body, tasked with enforcing the Sunshine Ordinance, fears in simply enforcing the law as written? Could it be they fear the public? I have a copy of my statement, and on the draft minutes, which I received a copy, on the back is the statement. Here is a copy of those same minutes printed out from your website today, and voila, it's gone. What is it that you are so concerned about that someone is actually going to say here and then take the 150-word statement and summarize it in their own words, that you are afraid to put it out there honestly so that members of the public who go to your website to read the minutes can read the entire minutes, including the statement which was submitted? Now, there was a thing in there showing a link, but it was one of 14 different areas of blueprint, and it was very hard, and I had to look for it three times before I finally found it. You are one of the two bodies tasked with enforcing Sunshine, and the law says clearly that the 150-word statement should be in the minutes. The city attorney's office does not say the good government guide is in any way, shape, manner, or form a legal opinion. And as a result, it is in no way something that you can contradict the actual literal wording of the law. The law says in the minutes. Now, good and bad, the link is in the minutes. So if you want to count that, you actually did put it in the minutes, but you did it in such a way so that any member of the public would be deceived and would not see them. And I think that was the intention, which is also a Brown Act violation, to maintain the status quo and to silence political speech.
Any other public comment? We'll then move on to the next item of our agenda, consideration of whether under SF Campaign and Governmental Code Section 3.234C, the Commission should grant waivers to Office of Economic and Workforce Development employee Kiri S. McClellan from the one-year post-employment communications ban and the ban on compensation from contractors. Mr. St. Croix, would you like to introduce this item on the agenda?
Yes. As detailed in the staff memo, the position that Ms. McClellan has been offered and would like to take has been set up for the benefit of the city's hosting of the America's Cup, and that in this particular case, the staff recommendation is based on our perception that this would not actually create a conflict, but rather a benefit for the city, because the mutual mission of the city in hosting this Cup and this committee for raising funds and other organizational efforts dovetail in the same direction, which is why staff has recommended that the request for waiver be offered. Ms. McClellan is here, and I believe that there's also someone from the mayor's office to speak on behalf of this waiver request. I'm expecting someone from the president of the Board of Supervisors' office, although I don't see him yet. So,
Commissioners, any comments, discussion?
I'd like to hear Ms. McClellan and the representatives first. Thank you. Good evening. I'm Kiri McClellan, the project manager in the Office of Economic and Workforce Development. I would like to compliment your staff in helping me prepare and present the materials that are here today. I think they did a very accurate representation of the situation that I'm in, and that is that last year, the mayor's office asked me to be the project manager on the day-to-day basis for our bid, and I put together
the process of which to engage the community and put forth, working with the Mayor's Office and the Board of Supervisors, the America's Cup proposal that was selected, and have been offered the opportunity to go over on the organizing committee side, which is the nonprofit. It's one of three members of the host city agreement, and they are charged with raising $32 million for the city. The organizing committee is made up of about 50 members of the community and members of the Board of Supervisors, as well as elected officials at the state level and national level, all with an eye towards making this event as successful as possible, both from a financial standpoint, that the city is made whole, and that the community is engaged. And the organizing committee, I think, has reached out to me because I've laid that groundwork. Professionally, having worked for the city for about 11 years, this is a great opportunity for me to go out and sort of spread my wings, if you will, on a project that I've been working hard on and would allow me to, again, seize a professional development opportunity. So unless there are any specific questions, I think everything that's in the report accurately reflects the opportunity that's before me, and I appreciate your favorable consideration. I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Commissioners, any questions? Ms. McClellan?
Not right now, if the other representatives are here, but I might afterward.
Sure.
That's okay. If that's okay with you, Chair.
That's fine with me.
Good evening, Commissioners. My name is Nicole Wheaton, and I am the Mayor's Commission Liaison and Director of Appointments, and I am here to speak on his behalf tonight in support of Kiri's waivers. As you all know, Kiri has been our day-to-day project manager, and I think we are very confident in saying that we secured the bid, much in part due to the efforts of her and her team. Kiri has displayed a profound patience and ever-expanding awareness, and I would say comprehensive awareness, of the issues facing the city related to the implementation of this event. And this awareness, rightly so, has led her to this very new and exciting opportunity to serve as the executive director of the San Francisco America's Cup Organizing Committee. We all know, as Kiri mentioned, that the SFACOC is an independent nonprofit that was established to support our bid and now is charged with the successful implementation of this event. And the most important part of their work will by and far be privately raising funds to defray the direct costs to the city that will come from hosting the Cup. Now, putting on an event as extraordinary as this takes an extraordinary amount of teamwork, and it was a common theme. Teamwork was a common theme in securing the bid and remains a common theme as the city mobilizes to prepare. And this teamwork, in turn, supports a few common goals, those being to provide the city with thousands of jobs, to provide the citizens with a successful event, and to make sure that San Francisco's economy benefits exponentially in this process. The work of the SFACOC is imperative to achieving those goals. With that said, the mayor is confident that there is no one more capable of leading the important efforts of the SFACOC than Ms. McClellan, and he supports the appropriate actions taken tonight to make that possible.
Good evening, Commissioners. Sorry to be a little bit late, and thank you for having me here. My name is Judson True. I'm a legislative aide to Board of Supervisors President David Chu, and also here to speak in support of this particular waiver for Kiri McClellan. Our office has worked with her closely on the America's Cup since the middle of last year, and she's a person of incredible talent and integrity, and I think we're very lucky that she's going to continue to work with the city at the ACOC on this project. And it's I'm sure many, or if not all of you, are very carefully at any such request that comes before you. But in this case, we feel strongly that Ms. McClellan will be doing great work at the ACOC that will be of great benefit to the city in the next few years as we work to put on this incredibly complicated event. So I'm also happy to take any questions about our particular experiences working with her. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. True, and thank you, Ms. Wheaton, for your comments as well. Commissioners? Commissioner Ward?
So the staff, in the staff memo, it indicates that while you wouldn't, if we denied the waiver, experience any financial hardship, it says that the denial of a waiver will impose professional hardship because of her chosen career path and the unique nature of this opportunity. Can you share with us what your career path is?
Sure, I've never been great at that. What are you going to be doing in 5 years? Question. But let me give you my best take on it. In the mayor's office, I've worked on a number of projects, including first was the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine bid. This was back in 2004. The city was putting together a proposal to locate the stem cell headquarters here, and I was the day-to-day project manager on that. And it was located here. And they did eventually build out their staff, and there was never an offer to me per se, but that was an instance where I could have possibly left the city and gone into private service and expanded on my project management skill set. Same would be of the Olympic torch, or excuse me, the Olympic bid. I was part of the mayor's office project team working on this civic event to bring together and bid on the 2016 Olympic Games. And that eventually did not come into fruition, but we were able to get the Olympic torch relay. And so then I worked on that. And so there's been a series of opportunities professionally where I've worked on things in-house with my project management skills and then potentially looking at an opportunity to leave and expand on that and go into a management role on a major event. Having worked again on our Olympic bid, the Torch Relay, and now the America's Cup, the opportunity to transition from working for the city to an entity outside of the city, but working on a civic-minded project. This affords me the opportunity to leave city service, but work on a major civic event. And so I would say my professional development or my career would be to work on major civic events here in San Francisco as a professional outside of city service. So this has created that opportunity for me, and it really is once in a lifetime. I don't know that we would have a host committee in the future like this. I don't know what next event would be coming to San Francisco that I would work on within the Mayor's Cup, a World Cup, or an Olympics. Those are really in the offing. They're not here in the foreseeable future. So this is my opportunity to build on my professional development experience and move into the civic realm.
So this is a temporary position. What do you expect to do after this job is over?
Collapse.
That's a good question. what did you say?
Collapse.
Potentially. It's temporary in that if Oracle Racing doesn't win in 2013, it could go elsewhere. But conceivably, they will win. And I would venture to say there are a lot of people that are hoping that the Ellison team and Oracle Racing does win, because we look at this as potentially being here for a decade. If they continue to win, they would continue to hold the event likely in San Francisco. So while this really, I can only count on it being employment through 2013, I really hope that it goes beyond that. And frankly, if I'm successful in this, I may be able to work on other statewide or national events, sort of having cut my teeth in the private sector.
What's the possibility that you'd want to, after this job ended, come back to work for the city in your former position?
In all honesty, I can't preclude that from happening. I've really enjoyed my city service. It's been an honor here, and if the 2013 event, if someone else won and the cup went elsewhere, and I was offered the opportunity to work for the city again, I would be honored. It's been a privilege. So I wouldn't want to preclude that and say I don't ever envision seeking that opportunity or looking at it seriously, because it's been my pleasure. But I would hope to, you know, continue to work on meaningful projects that bring the community together, whatever that may be after the America's Cup.
Commissioners, questions?
I'm trying to walk through this looking at the purpose of these laws, because the commission has been always trying to balance, whenever they've come before us, the justification for the rules in the first place and the individual circumstances. And I'm as excited as about watching these races as anybody. So I think many of us are aware of the partnership that's anticipated. But we on the commission have a special responsibility to think about why these rules are in place, what could happen in the positive scenarios, but what could happen that might make it awkward or challenging to have granted the waiver. So if you'll give me a minute. I look at the provisions, and the one I'm particularly cared about is the waiver on post-employment communication with the departments that you've been involved with. So the provisions are part of the post-employment laws enacted to protect the integrity of government decision-making by preventing an official or employee from using his or her influence or knowledge gained as a public servant to advance private interests at the expense of the public. And I certainly agree that there are a lot of ways in which this is expected to be a partnership where the interests of the public, the city, the organizing committee will converge. But I'm also reminded that these rules apply to many other people who leave city service and go to nonprofit organizations that may share with the city a global value that is the city's as well, taking care of citizens in various categories, generating funding for healthcare and community service and arts organizations. And these rules apply to people in those kinds of positions. So I have been trying to think about whether we could anticipate things where those interests might diverge and do something now that would allow us to grant the waiver but with conditions to apply to those, or allow, and that's sometimes very hard to imagine what might come up, or to think about what could happen and what the Ethics Commission or the participants in this process might do later. So I tried to think whether we could anticipate now places where the interests might diverge and the knowledge that you had as a public servant could be used in ways that these rules are intended right now to protect. For example, and I realize there's a time issue, so it may be that these could happen, but it's unlikely they would happen in the first year, and that might give us greater comfort. I'm just sort of trying to walk my way through. If, for example, the organizing committee could not raise all of the funds that it had committed to raise, and the city coffers were in slightly better condition than they are right now, then the knowledge of what resources the city had, what levers the city had, how to renegotiate with the city and say, we can't do all of what we thought, or we can't do it on the timetable we thought, could your having been in public service to know how those things were done inside could strengthen the hands of the organizing committee in a way that would provide greater leverage than one of us taking that job would have when we went to the city to rework some of those provisions. I'm not asking you to address that one, and you're standing there, I'm not sure I have I'm asking you a question, but I'm trying to think through whether the positive picture that we have about how this could work well could break down such that the knowledge of the inner workings of the city negotiations could come back to give you the ability to do exactly what these rules were, or anybody in your position. I'm not saying that you would, mm-hmm. I don't know you, that you would intentionally do anything that was against the interests of the city, but these rules are meant to apply broadly. So I think I'm really asking the commissioners to help me think about whether you have any hesitation, whether you think there are any kinds of conditions on this or spotlight that would help address possibilities that might be cumbersome for us to imagine but that could arise, or whether you feel that this is something that you're comfortable with, because I really would appreciate, since we are not allowed to talk to each other beforehand about these things, I'm truly interested in hearing what these folks have to say and what the public has to say, because it, and then I would be interested if you have something that you want to add, because a lot of this will be both what do people think of our doing it here and what kind of precedent might it create for, while this is a distinctive enterprise, it is not radically different from the other kinds of, for other kinds of nonprofit organizations that share an objective with the city. But there's a reason that this was structured as a separate entity with separate protections and separate goals and expectations. And I'm trying to think how we can be sure that they, for your sake, for the organizing committee's sake, and for the city's sake, is there something that we can do to make those things clear and simple if interests diverge? But it seems like you'd like to comment.
I was just going to interject in terms of my role within the mayor's office and give you perspective on the team that was in place during the negotiations. Mm-hmm. I was a member of a larger team. So we had members of the port staff, members of the Mayor's Office of Economic and Workforce Development, probably a good four or five people that represented the cities plus council as part of the decision making. So, and that now is even being further superseded potentially with my departure. There's a new, there's project director, there's additional project staff. So the city's team wasn't, I don't want to make it sound like I was the sole person responsible for this coming here, nor was I the only one involved in the decision making. So the team was quite broad. And I'm just trying to address a piece of my prior
role. Can you tell me how you think that cuts or how that affects the kinds of exploration I was trying to do?
Yeah, and the reason I bring it up is that I'm not a one single person with information that was unique, that I somehow am a volume of unique information. Mm-hmm. I was one of a larger team of people that were involved and making decisions, and so I don't possess any unique interests that on working on the organizing committee side would have an advantage over the rest of the team that remains in place and works on this. So I don't think I take with me something that is to the city's disadvantage. It actually, I think, sort of strengthens the working relationship.
Although that raises an interesting other question, because part of this reasoning is influence and knowledge are the two conditions. So the fact that this is a team that you've worked with, part of the logic for having rules about post-employment communication back to a set of folks that one has worked with is that if we leave a place and we leave it in with good relationships, we have more credibility, more influence over our former colleagues. And I've lived under rules like this when I've left federal service, so I understand the reason for these constraints. So the better you know people and the more highly they think of you, the more clout the outsider then has with the people who remain. And I don't have to distrust any of you to say that there was an issue of human nature that led to the creation of these rules in the first place. So we need to think carefully when we allow waivers.
If I could, I'd like to address Commissioner Studley's comments. And my earlier line question was really around returning to city service after you've been in that position. I mean, it just seems to me that that's there's got to be some, I don't have any problem with, and I think that your case falls within the reasonable possibility of issuing a waiver. But what I am uncomfortable with is the possibility of kind of a revolving door where you're temporarily on loan to an outside entity and dealing with folks that you have worked with, have supervised, and possibly would work with and supervise in the future. That's my concern. If you're making a decision to leave public service and go to the private sector to pursue a career in the private sector, that's fine with me. I think that a waiver under these circumstances, I'd be happy to vote in favor of that. But it concerns me the possibility that the career path is not in the private sector, but only temporarily in the private sector in order to take this position. I suppose it's a dream job, and I'd love to see you with it. But I think I'd want some assurance that, you know, you're in the public sector, you're in the public sector. There's got to be something on one side or the other. It's got to be a restraint either on this side of it or on the other side of it. So if I felt like you weren't coming back to city government within a year of your leaving this post, I'd feel more comfortable about voting in favor of the waiver.
Okay.
Mr. St. Croix, is that something that is something we would consider in the analysis?
No, we wouldn't have jurisdiction over someone in the private sector, leaving the private sector. Could I say something?
Sure.
I think that if I were to get a dream job like this and take it and then it was over and I needed work, I would take work wherever I could get it just because I have to work. In terms of a conflict with someone going to the private sector and coming back, I think in a position like this, the level of professional development that Ms. McClellan will gain will mean she's even more talented than she already is. So if she came back to the city, they'd be getting someone who had all the talent she has now, plus some additional ones.
But the people that work for her would also be getting someone back that is, you know, if they know she's coming back, what are they going to do?
They're going to
do exactly what she asked them to do.
And
I understand.
If I can interject, I don't supervise anybody in my current role. I am a member of the project team, but I am supervised. I'm the lowest one on the totem pole in our project. Is another way to put it.
Being the executive director of this,
I will supervise people in the nonprofit. Yes, sir.
And you will have taken a step up.
Yes, sir.
And if you return to the city, I doubt whether or not you'd return in your current position. So that's my point. How you can influence people who think that you might be their boss in the future.
Anybody else have questions for Ms. McClellan? I have a few, Ms. McClellan.
Go ahead.
The agreement that you helped negotiate, does that require any payment by the city to the committee that you are now moving to?
No.
So all of the provisions in the agreement, none of them require any payment from the city to the committee?
None. It's exactly the opposite direction. The organizing committee is raising money for the city.
Okay. Secondly, when did you first learn that you may be considered for this position?
About a month and a half ago.
When was the agreement completed?
The agreement was finalized on December 31st. So it was not until well after that that the chairman of the organizing committee said to me, you know, we're official. We're going to be forming ourselves. Why don't you consider this opportunity? So,
if you know, what are the provisions in the agreement, going to Commissioner Sudley's point of renegotiating the agreement? What does it provide for there?
Gosh, there's not so much an opportunity to renegotiate as there is an opportunity to walk away from this event. If the organizing committee doesn't raise sufficient funds, the city has the opportunity to walk away. I think it's 7 days after CEQA. The same is true if there are certain mitigations that come out of the CEQA process that the event authority finds, you know, unbearable for them to put on the event. They can cancel and walk away. So there are some opportunities at the end of this year where they would, both the city and the event authority have that. Then the execution of the venue leases, which is between the event authority and the Port of San Francisco, and it conceivably would come also to the Board of Supervisors, are where some of the details that were not fully fleshed out in the host city agreement will come to fruition and be executed, exactly where they're investing their funds and what property they get for that. So
under the agreement, what are the city's obligations to the committee, if any?
Gosh, I would.
In broad strokes, what is the city agreeing to do?
The city and the organizing committee will have an MOU in the next 30 to 60 days that cover their relationship. And it's more so the expenses that the city will be forwarding to the organizing committee for reimbursement, really structured around what's supports costs, what's rec parks costs, what's city attorney costs, what do those all look like, and what is the schedule for their payment. That's really what's going to be governed under the agreement between the city and the organizing committee. I would say there really isn't any obligation that the city has to the committee. It really is all going in the other direction.
And Mr. St. Croix, is that consistent with the staff's understanding of the agreement? Have you guys reviewed it? Any other questions for Ms. McClellan? Thank you. Commissioner Sudley, to your point, my view is that if we are sure and feel comfortable that there is no payment going from the city to the committee, that the risk that would otherwise be present in some situations would not be present here, that we could be certainly more assured that the concerns that the employment restrictions are created to address would be less likely to be present here.
I think that's, for me, that's not entirely a bright line, but on balance, I feel like I can vote for the waiver. I think that is very relevant, but haven't quite thought through whether there are other responsibilities and elements of that relationship.
The renegotiation that does concern me some too, because you're right. The relationship could change, and certainly Ms. McClellan would have information having been on the other side of the same table.
Right. The city has such an incentive to make this work that that I just wonder whether somebody who knows the ways in which it's important to the city, even if it's not cash transactions, might have a special advantage. In some ways, the very visibility of this entire process either makes the chance of a waiver being criticized greater or makes the scrutiny and the fact that there will be a lot of interest in all of its transactions more secure, because I think there will be a public interest and a funder interest and a city interest and concern. So it's trying to recognize the spirit of the underlying rule and think about whether this is safe enough to, and I take seriously that the public officials feel that this is something that would be constructive and that they've considered the risks and the benefits and would therefore also be watchful about making sure that there were not negative consequences for the city from the grant of a waiver.
Question for the staff. Has the provision regarding communications with a former department, has that ever been Has the hardship ever been interpreted to mean professional hardship versus financial hardship previous to this request?
I'm not aware that this particular provision has ever been invoked in a waiver request. Usually post-employment restrictions regard compensation. And those that have been granted are the ones where, generally, where people are going into a field where they are going to conduct work that's conducive to a better city, as it were.
But don't we typically get these requests after the person has left, too?
Not necessarily.
In my experience here, we've been talking to people who have already left their position.
It's happened both ways, yeah.
I just wanted to add that the one-year restriction on communicating with your former department, the reason that the commission may grant the waiver is not really based on financial hardship. That's really the reason for financial or some kind of hardship.
It's
the contracting one. Just to clarify that.
Right. The financial hardship goes with the one-year.
I'm sorry. I was referring to the wrong provision, but I was looking at that paragraph. Thank you for the clarification, Ms. Singh. That certainly was something that I noticed when looking at it. But again, in a situation where this isn't really the award of a government contract to a third party who's receiving government funds, to me the risk seems low, and I certainly recognize the great benefit to the city by having Ms. McClellan in the position. So on balance, it seems it's not like something I would support.
If I could go back to the item that Commissioner Herr was talking about, referred to the page 4, item B, the commission may grant a waiver from the ban on employment with city contractors if it finds the restriction would cause extreme hardship. But is that the only basis for granting a waiver? So that's why you were struggling to make it work.
The answer is yes for the a waiver on the contracting ban.
Right. Because as I think about the reason for having that contracting ban, it's so that people don't contract in ways that then create opportunities for them. And we have the testimony from Ms. McClellan that the contract was concluded before the opportunity was brought to her attention. Any reasonable person might have anticipated that if successful, somebody would have to run this enterprise. But there were a number of people involved for the city and others who were also learning about it and active in that process. But if the loss is the only basis for a waiver is extreme hardship for the individual, we need to base our judgment on that term.
But nothing in the provision excludes defining hardship more broadly than financial hardship, though, right?
Right.
You want to take public comment before or after the motion? You can do both.
Would anybody like to make a motion?
I'll just say I'm considering making a motion, but I'd like to hear the public comment, so I'd happy to make the motion and then see if there's public comment that reveals any, opens new avenues, or to hear the comment before the motion.
Okay,
in case it changes.
I'm open to the commissioners. We do the motion first.
Okay. I move that we grant both of the waivers requested.
Public comment.
If you could let me know when I have 1 minute left, please. Ray Hartstrector, San Francisco Open Government. I spent 12 years in the United States Navy, and after that I spent another 14 years dealing with federal and state employees and military personnel doing training, 14 years with the University of Hawaii as a lecturer, and also did work with the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, the City and County of Honolulu, and so forth. So I'm very familiar with a lot of the interactions that go on. And the thing that concerns me is the bottom of page 3. In her work for the city, Ms. McClellan was active in negotiating the agreement, in overseeing management of the city's efforts to host the event, and in organizing community outreach and support for the event. As any of you must know, when you're involved in a negotiation, there are a lot of things that you will say in private to each other that you would never say to the opposing negotiation team. And as a result, there are certain things you would say, well, we're willing to give up this and not give up that. We'd be willing to let go of this, let go of that. Any contract, once it is signed, is still subject to interpretation. And as a result, the committee would have access to all of the information that was included in the deliberations throughout the process of negotiating this, including anything that they had said, well, you know, if push comes to shove, we'd do this. We can't live without that. And as a result, it would give them an unfair advantage. It would be like someone leaving a company like General Motors and going to work for the United Auto Workers. They would have access to privy to financial information, all sorts of negotiating information, things that the company would do their best to keep from the other side, because it would put them in an awkward position and hamstring them in future negotiations. Any contract, no matter how well written, is going to be up for negotiation at some point in the future when it comes down to an issue about, well, how do we exactly interpret this, that, or the other part of it? And that is the concern I think that Commissioner Studley was looking at, is the fact that are we taking someone who is intimately involved on the side of the city and then simply taking them and putting them on the other side, which gives them the total advantage? They know everybody's argument. They now know the argument of the committee, which is what side they're on now, and they also know all of the arguments that were placed and who were the supporters, the detractors, et cetera, all the politics involved. And I think that's really, really questionable in a contract of this size and of this importance, of taking someone who is in city service and simply turning all of their knowledge and experience in that job over to the other side.
David Pilpel, several comments. First, the Department of Economic and Workforce Development is actually now a standalone department. It used to be part of the mayor's office, but I believe under the admin code it's actually a standalone department at the present time. The documents that were referenced, the host city agreement, documents related to the authority and the organizing committee, are not actually before you. So I'm not disagreeing with any of the representations that were made, but we just don't have those documents to review, so it's difficult to come to our own beliefs about what they may mean and what requirements the city has and the obligations of the other parties. We've also heard that there is a committee including various people, but again, that list of people involved is not before us in the record. On a going forward basis, and I believe I've said this at other prior waiver requests, I believe that these are the kinds of things that we should charge a fee for considering this waiver request. It involves an employee, it involves obtaining compensation, and obviously staff time and public time was involved in this. It seems to me like we ought to consider that in the future. A couple of other concerns and questions. It's not clear from the analysis whether communications with the port would be covered or just communications with ECN, as I like to call it. Also, it's not clear what involvement Ms. McClellan had in since the position was offered. In response to one of the questions, she indicated that the opportunity was presented about a month and a half ago. It's not clear since then if she has stepped away from direct involvement in negotiating with the entity that she might serve with. And certainly until and unless a waiver is granted, I would think that she should be cautioned with regard to her involvement there should it become an issue. To conclude, if this is granted, and I have no objection to granting it, I think it should be specific and limited to this entity and this project, so that in the event that some other opportunity comes up in the next year, that she's not granted unlimited access to communicate with the department on other issues which she may or may not have been involved in, like Park Merced or Treasure Island or anything else that that department has been involved in. And I was also thinking about other individuals throughout the city family that have gone both directions. I take seriously Commissioner Ward's question, and I can think of a couple of instances, but not exactly like this. And I'm thinking some more about that. But in any event, I appreciate the commission's consideration on this. I think that this does implicate some broader issues. And while the simple analysis may be that under these circumstances it's warranted, it does raise these other issues. Thank you very much.
Before we take a,
yes.
a vote, I just want to say something. I mean, I'm torn by this because I don't want to stand in the way of someone else's opportunity. But I have to say, I don't think this is a good idea. I really don't. I don't believe that the hardship that not being able to leave your city job to take another job is like a hardship. So I think this is kind of forced reasoning around the what the statute requires. My sense is that you have the votes for the waiver, but I really don't feel like this is a very good precedent around the issue of professional hardship. It's just kind of a stretch for me.
Was there any other public comment? Any other comments from the commissioners?
I am wondering, as I weigh all of this, whether there might be any interest or value in, since some of the comments have gone to renegotiation of the agreement, where the insider knowledge that has been gained would be most at issue, whether it might be possible, since it is the parties consider it unlikely, it may not happen during the first year, but it raises the most risk or most concern if it were to do so, whether we might consider granting the waiver, but as to the communication with the city during the year, cabinet that Ms. McClellan would not be, that the waiver would not apply to renegotiating the base agreement, so that she could, to allow her to take the position and to communicate about the constructive, forward-going partnership. So I let that marinate for a moment in your minds. I'm also thinking that some of that is made simpler by, in some ways, by the fact that the mayor, the Board of Supervisors, are on the honorary committee, and if the honorary committee has any meeting, even simply allowing the use of their names, the same city interests that are available through Ms. McLennan as one of the members of a negotiating team are also in the minds of these senior officials who, at least the mayor or his designees, were part of the thinking about what the city could agree to, and that they have that same knowledge. So she's not the only one connected with this enterprise who has the potential that some folks were talking about to know what the inner conversation was. And so even if we precluded her, we do not have the control over these people and the information that's available to them. So we could be constraining the individual and the project, but to no avail because other people know the same things that she knows. I see some lack of enthusiasm for burdening the waiver idea, but I'd be interested in the commissioners and the staff thinking on that.
Mr. St. Croix, do you have
Any thoughts on that?
Clearly does.
I can't, you know, if it's as simple as it sounds, it probably works, but I can't, I'm trying to conceive of what limitations you're putting on someone that may have to have, you know, you can't have a director of an organization enter into critical negotiations and cut that person off.
I do share the concern that it may make the position untenable for Ms. McClellan. I mean, the notion that the director of the committee or the person heading up the committee would not have the opportunity to be involved in discussing the contract seems like a pretty, would at least in the abstract, seem like a big problem. Mr. True, it looks like you have some comment.
Sorry to raise my hand. It's grade school. Again, Judson True from President Chu's office. It's been very interesting to listen to the discussion. A lot of great points from all the commissioners and Mr. St. Croix. I wanted to make the point about this particular issue because President Chu's office and myself were intimately involved in the negotiations around the host city agreement and the discussions with the ACOC as well. And I think it's important. What I wanted to point out is that there are really three entities that are a party to the host city agreement, and I know this is in the memo, the city, the ACOC, which is a nonprofit, and then the event authority. And I think, as has been discussed, the ACOC has essentially obligations to the city to raise this money and to help. And honestly, during the, you know, often tense negotiations in December, the ACOC was always very helpful, and Mr. Buell, as a president, was always, or the chair, I believe is his title, was always helpful vis-a-vis the event authority and really on the side of the city to bring this here. And I think if there were discussions, which we don't anticipate around changes of the host city agreement over the year ahead, they would most likely be with the event authority rather than the ACOC. And if anything, we would look to the expertise of the ACOC and its leadership, both from the board level and the staff level, to advise the city in helpful ways. I mean, we really don't anticipate such a negotiation. We do have future negotiations, not with the ACOC, but with the event authority around long-term leases, short-term leases, long-term leases. A lot of important work to be done, but we don't see that. It's not clear to me exactly with the obligations being to the city from the ACOC, what we would renegotiate with them or how we wouldn't want their expertise, that expertise. And perspective, if we were in some sort of discussions. That's the only point I wanted to make because I know President Chu and I will be involved in any discussions around those long-term leases. And almost all those discussions, by the way, will be after a year, except for the short-term leases, the really important ones.
Could you just drop a footnote and explain the responsibilities of the event authority?
That's quite an extensive list. Both the city and the event authority have extensive obligations. I mean, the event authority, the most important obligation that they have besides putting in the race is to make the initial investment of at least $55 million in infrastructure improvements that are to the city's benefit, and that's where the leases come in on the back end. And so, the host city agreement is all about the obligations that both the city has and the event authority has to make this race successful. I mean, the bottom line is that all three of these parties, while there are certain interests that don't absolutely align on the micro level, at the macro level, all three, the city, the event authority, and the ACOC are obligated and committed to working together to make this incredibly important event a success that will create almost 10,000 jobs and provide more than $1 billion of economic impact to the city. And we see the ACOC's success as really crucial to that because the city is going to have some costs that we want this philanthropic money to reimburse us for and this raised money. And we see the leadership at the ACOC as really important to the success of that nonprofit.
That's actually very helpful to me because I didn't understand the addition that the authority was separate from the organizing committee.
It is. It's. I mean, the event authority is the is the, essentially the team that and the entity created by the team. And we, I think we would be having a very different conversation if Ms. McClellan was looking to work for the event authority. I don't think it would be the same. I don't think I would be standing here. Not that we don't love the event authority. We're going to work really well with them over the next few years, but that's why I wanted to talk again. So thank you for your time.
Mr. True, I actually have a few more questions for you now that you're here.
I didn't even bring my file. So
who were the principal negotiators of this agreement for the city?
The principal negotiators of the host city agreement were the mayor's office, the Department of Economic and Workforce Development, Jennifer Matz, the city attorneys who worked on that for her. I know that the mayor's office, the mayor and the mayor's chief of staff at the time were involved. We were certainly, President Chu was certainly involved on specific points. And then, of course, the port was a huge part of it. And Ms. McClellan worked for Ms. Matz and worked on it. But then the port, everyone from the executive director, Monique Moyer, to Brad Benson, special projects, and Jonathan Stern, the head of real estate, I was on the phone over the holidays outside of St. Louis. My mother was trying to get me to play cards, and I was back on the phone with the negotiating team just on some of the points as we really tried to get across the finish line, which was a big challenge and a big lift for the city at the end of last year.
And did the committee ask the city for a recommendation for who should be in Ms. McClellan's position?
I have no knowledge in particular of any of those conversations. We did not have any conversations with anyone from the ACOC about this position. I was pleasantly surprised when I heard, and I know President Chu was as well, when we heard that Ms. McClellan might have this opportunity, because it seemed like it could be a very big benefit to the city, even though we're sad to see her go from OEWD.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other comments from the commissioners? There's a motion that's been made and seconded, so we take a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? So the motion passes. Congratulations.
Congratulations. Good luck.
Do our city proud. The next item on the agenda is consideration of policy directives regarding possible amendments to the campaign finance ordinance. Mr. St. Croix, would you like to introduce this item?
It's one of the most important things that we have to do is to track third-party spending in elections because of the enormous potential influence they have. We have a lot of rules to that end, and they're getting to be a bit unwieldy, mostly because we've amended or adopted separate rules and regulations at different times, and we realize that it's not only become burdensome for the filers, but also for the staff. So we started looking at things we could do to coordinate and simplify some of these. It's gotten more and more complicated. So we had hoped to bring actual drafted legislation to you at this meeting, but there's too much work to be done. So we prepared the staff memo that you have, hoping that you'll give us some of your initial reactions, either at this meeting or if you would communicate directly to me afterwards via email as to which directions we should go in. We also determined, too, that we want to make sure that that we have support for these kind of efforts. So we're going to convene at least one interested persons meeting to get some feedback from the public. It may be that we use that feedback to create legislation and then maybe seek some more feedback once we have documents to work off of. So we left it on the agenda, even though we don't have prepared legislation, to encourage you to review what we have, give us any ideas that you commissioners might come up with again tonight or in the future, and to make an initial request that members of the public who are interested in this issue also forward comments to us, either through the interested persons meeting or in writing.
Commissioners, any comments, questions?
I certainly applaud the review with an eye toward burden on people who have to report to us. And they seem to me to be reasonable, a reasonable balancing in what you've described between simplification and yet still providing the information that people who want to understand how funding is traveling and the potential for influencing elections, and that that happens early enough to be informative while people can still use the information that is requested. So to this degree, they sounded like constructive directions. The devil is, we know where the devil is.
Right.
I'd be interested to hear whether, you know, the public's thinking about whether these strike that balance as well.
Public comment on this issue?
My name is Richard Hansen, and by way of background, I happen to be married to Mrs. Hansen, who spoke before. We have been members of a very small Democratic club in the Richmond District in San Francisco for some time, and we take seriously participation in the elections, and we spend a lot of time looking at issues and looking at candidates. Our total influence is fairly small because there's big money in politics in San Francisco, as you well know, and it's gotten to be an issue where the big spenders, when you talk about a $1 million campaign or $300,000 campaign, those folks are able to employ a vast variety of professionals, fundraisers, accountants, all sorts of consultants, and I think they have really an undue influence on the politics in the city. You want to get the lowest level of the voters involved in the sense that they really are having a part in the government. And these reporting requirements really are onerous for small clubs, and it scares most people away. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
I'm Shirley Hansen again, and the total amount that we spend on a slate card is about $5,000. Not a lot of money. But the reporting requirements are so onerous. We're just spending hours and hours, and I guess most clubs have to get an accountant to do it. And one of the problems I have is I can't quit as treasurer. We have such a small club. There's nobody in my club who could pick this up and figure out how to make an Excel file to put in 200 and something numbers in order to come out with what we have to report from that slate card. There are maybe six candidates that we spent over $100 on. Okay, and what you really need is how much did we spend on those six candidates? And the amount of work that we have to do is so ridiculous, and that should really be covered in whatever you do here, because the balance in our account now is about $3,000. And a few years ago, someone volunteered to be treasurer and just couldn't figure it out. And her mother was dying. She was late. We ended up owing $5,000 penalty, which we finally, dropped the penalty, and I was told that the only reason that they will drop a penalty is a death in the family, and that was why they dropped our penalty. But We're only spending, you know, $5,000, so something needs to be done about that. Thank you.
And again, if you could let me know when I have 1 minute. Commissioners Ray Hartz, Director of San Francisco Open Government. I think we know that the recent Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, really put some sort of a question mark on who in the heck is going to be paying for all of our elections, whether it's federal, state, or local elections. I think in city elections, it is most important because in a city, it is much more likely that small groups of citizens can combine and form groups in which they may have some influence by being able to work for a candidate and contribute to a candidate, offer hours, and raise money. And unfortunately, there is, even in the small microcosm of San Francisco, a significant number of very, very well-endowed individuals and groups who can really just obliterate any chance that a small group may have any meaningful ability to participate in a comment and work for an underdog or so forth that they would really like to see elected. I think that the city government needs to have some fairly clear instructions, and I think they also need to put into the equation what the previous instructor or the previous speaker has said on a couple of occasions, which is the onerousness of the paperwork involved. If you're in a big campaign like the woman who ran for governor here in the state and spent $170 million of her own money, I'm sure she had absolutely no problem at all making sure that all the paperwork was right as long as she wanted the information out there to begin with. But a group like a small Democratic club and groups that have traditionally, I think, in San Francisco and many of the Bay Area communities have really been put at a disadvantage as it is. Now, as far as this particular change, I really can't say anything about it specifically because I don't know what the law currently says and I don't know what the proposed changes are. And as a result, I don't think anybody can make an intelligent comment as to what the changes would be, what they were now, what they are now, what they would be, and what the effect would be. But I think that one of the considerations that has to be made is looking at making sure that small groups still have a viable way of participating in the democratic process, including issues of fundraising and support, financial support for candidates.
Good evening, Commissioners. Anita Mayo, Pillsbury, Winthrop, Shaw, Pittman. I just wanted to applaud the staff for beginning to think about how to simplify the campaign finance reform ordinance. It does have burdensome reporting and disclosure requirements, and the aggregate contribution limit in San Francisco, I think, really diminishes an individual's ability to participate in the political process by limiting contributions to the number of elective offices on the ballot. So thinking about changing that, I think, is a great step forward, and I look forward to the interested persons meeting and looking at the draft legislation. Thank you.
Hi, Kevin Hennigan from the Sutton Law Firm. I, too, would like to applaud the staff for kind of after this past cycle kind of taking a step back and figuring out if there's a way to streamline the filing of the third-party spending forms. Staff did this 2 years ago after the last cycle, and the regime that's in place now is much better than the one that was in place 2 years ago, and I'm sure that kind of when this process works its way through, it'll be even more streamlined. A couple suggestions for kind of staff as kind of they proceed in this process. The first, it seems like it's going to happen. I think it'd be a great idea to convene an interested persons meeting to get input from various stakeholders. A couple other kind of more substantive comments. The reporting regime is based on kind of forms that the Ethics Commission has created, and each form for the different types of communications requires different information. I would urge the staff to figure out if there's a way to use the existing forms, campaign finance forms, that committees file on a regular basis, whether it's the Form 465, which is an independent expenditure report, or a late independent expenditure report, which is a Form 497. These are reports that kind of the Political Reform Act determines what goes on it, and it's just something that, you know, all committees, large or small, are familiar with filing, and it wouldn't require, you know, duplicative reporting, and it would be easier for everybody to comply. And then the other kind of suggestion is maybe requiring the reports to be filed on a weekly basis or a biweekly basis as opposed to every 24 hours. In certain situations, you'll have one committee that's supporting and opposing various candidates in a race, and you know, at least at our firm, we'll have staff tracking with these massive spreadsheets of tracking, you know, when a activity supporting or opposing a particular candidate has reached just a certain threshold. And kind of the report's triggered when you reach a certain threshold. So you might have the same committee filing, you know, a report every single day for different candidates. So if you just kind of made a set deadline that the report's due, you know, once a week or once every couple of weeks, it might kind of streamline the process for everybody. That's all I had. Thanks.
David Pilpel and I, too, look forward to the interested persons workshop. We always have a lot of fun at those. With regard to the three items that the staff memo references, and I agree with the comments that to the extent that we can combine forms and have streamlined and similar procedures, that is good. From my experience in various ways, it is difficult now for a variety of players who actually want to comply to figure out what applies, and at the same time for members of the public who are interested in looking at the broad range of activity that's out there, how to find what's happening and look at it more consistently. So to that end, where there are different disclosure requirements, I would encourage that we go with the most open, most public requirement. So for example, the mass mailing disclosure requirement only applies to certain actors under certain circumstances. If that can be applied more broadly to any mailed communication attempting to influence an election in the city, that a copy of that needs to go to the commission within X number of days, depending on how close it is to the election, that would be good. When there is a telephone communication, that whoever the entity is that's paying for it should maintain a copy of the script. If there are email blasts that are going out, some of which may not be currently regulated, each entity should keep a copy of that communication and the approximate number of individuals that they were sending that to, that kind of thing. Same thing on the paid for by. It should be paid for, it should say paid for by in whatever point size we choose, whoever it's paid for by, not just candidate committees, but whoever is within our scope of regulation that we can require that of. And finally, on the cumulative contribution limits, although it may seem odd, I actually support this reform. It has always struck me as odd that there's an aggregate limit that relates to the number of candidates or the number of offices on the ballot rather than anything else. It just seems incredibly arbitrary. And although it would likely allow major contributors to contribute more than they do now because they wouldn't be limited by 500 times the number of offices, so be it. They have other opportunities to send money in different ways, and this would make it more transparent in my view. So people would be encouraged to contribute directly to candidates in whatever amount they chose, subject to the $500 limit, rather than the way that it happens now. Again, I look forward to the IP meeting. Thanks.
The next item on the, I guess we don't take a motion. There's no motion made on that. But thank you, staff. I think agree with comments that this is a welcome change and look forward to what you come up with. The next item on the agenda is the minutes from the meeting on February 14th, 2011. Any proposed amendments?
Before we move on to that, may I just add that we've tentatively scheduled the interested persons meeting for March 24th, 12:30 in room 421, City Hall.
Thank you. Any comments on the minutes? Is there a motion to accept?
Adopt, yeah.
Adopt the minutes from the February 14th, 2011 meeting?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Public comment. Oh, public comments. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The next item on the agenda is the Executive Director's report.
A couple of highlights. I do anticipate longer meetings in April and possibly in May. So just so you know, and if I think it's going to be really long, I'll let you know ahead of time. Last week I was invited to testify at the Budget and Finance Committee about the status of the Election Campaign Fund, which we use to give money to public finance candidates. As you probably already know, there's $5 million in the fund right now. The city will be depositing another $2 million in the fund at the beginning of the fiscal year on July 1st. The measure before the committee was to add back another $1.2 million out of the money that was previously deappropriated by the mayor's office, which right now is about $5.5 million. Was adopted on a 3-2 vote, so it goes to the full board. The $7 million that we definitely have is the minimum that we think we need for the mayoral race taking place this year. There are 8 what I would consider first-tier candidates. You might argue that there's 10. So far, 2 have applied for public financing and been met the criteria, so we've sent 2 initial checks out so far, $50,000 each. There are 6 candidates that have raised over $50,000, another one that's raised over $100,000, and one that's raised over $250,000. We don't have exact tracking. Candidates have to report to us when they hit the $50,000 mark. They don't report again until they hit the million mark. So as best as we can figure, that's where we're at. It's possible that we could spend in excess even that. So if we're going to have over $8 million, we still may need to draw down from the money, again, that was previously deappropriated. We do have a commitment from the mayor's office that if we need that money, we'll have access to it. But we anticipate coming through this fiscal year using everything that's in the fund. And I so testified at the board. That's all I have for highlights.
Thank you, Mr. St. Croix. Any discussion by the commissioners?
Yes.
Public comment?
David Pilpel again. Just in reference to future meetings being long, what we had done several years ago was have a list of future calendar items that was either attached to the executive director's report or included somewhere in the agenda. I would encourage going back to that. So if there are things that are intended for the May meeting, that be listed somewhere, or if there are things that haven't yet been scheduled but are coming up in the next 6 months or so, that both the commissioners, the staff, and the public have an opportunity to kind of gauge where policy or other agenda items are in the future. I would encourage you to think about that again. Thanks.
The next item on the agenda is items for future meetings. Commissioners, any proposed agenda items?
I should state that in the chair has indicated that we will have our annual discussion of priorities at an upcoming meeting, probably in April or May. So that's something you all should be thinking about. Okay.
Any public comment?
Public comment.
public comment on matters appearing or not appearing on the agenda.
And once again, Commissioners, Ray Hartz, Director of San Francisco Open Government. I'm in possession of a November 15, 2010 response to an Ethics Commission complaint filed October 19, 2010. The complaint was dismissed on 2 points from the Good Government Guide. I would like to quote from the same source. Quote, "So please be prudent, understand that no publication can substitute for the careful consideration of the application of laws to specific content," unquote. This is from page 1 of the introduction, signed by the city attorney. It is his introduction. Using the Good Government Guide as a justification for ignoring the actual wording of a law is at best disingenuous and at worst outright dishonest. Also, trying to imply a difference in application of the Sunshine Ordinance with respect to bodies which are or are not enumerated in the charter is even more suspect. The agendas of every city policy body enumerated in the charter or not state, quote, "know your rights under the Sunshine Ordinance," unquote. I've heard this argument, and it's in the City Good Government Guide, and it makes absolutely no sense. Does that mean that there are actually two versions of the Sunshine Ordinance, one which applies to enumerated bodies and one which does not? And if so, I would like to make a public, an immediate disclosure request to get a copy of the one that applies to the ones that are not enumerated in the charter. Because basically what I'm experiencing is if they're not enumerated in the charter, what they simply say when you say, "I know my rights under Sunshine," and file an appeal is, "We're not enumerated in the charter, so we don't have to do that." So basically what they do is get to pick and choose the parts of the Sunshine Ordinance that they follow or choose not to follow. I think that goes in the face of the Equal Protection Clause. People should not, in this city, have to wonder whether or not the body they're going before is actually enumerated in the charter or not, and if it is not, wonder what parts of the Sunshine Ordinance can I actually rely on. And that's what these arguments really amount to. They are dishonest. They are disingenuous. I don't know whether you want to call it the bad or the good, but bottom line is a city citizen of this city should not have to worry about their rights under the Sunshine Ordinance based on whether or not they know that body is enumerated in the charter. You can't have the law both ways, especially when it's left to no one but the body to decide for themselves, oh, we just don't have to obey that part. And that's what I've heard done, and that's what I see in the Good Government Guide, and that's one of the two reasons that this complaint was dismissed. You are one of the two bodies tasked with enforcing Sunshine. Are there two different versions?
Any other public comment? Then this meeting is adjourned. No, we got a vote.
So moved.
No, we want to stay.
I move we adjourn.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
It is so hard to get.
Thanks for indulging all the rookie mistakes.
I don't know. I've been doing them 2 years ago.